Right, so one of the key risks, this is very familiar. Just to remind you though, that risk is not something homogeneous. There are at least three core kinds of risk that we'll have in a financial crisis, and we need to think about them separately. And the obvious point, but it's really important to remember it: credit risk, that you don't discharge your contract; the liquidity risk, arising usually from maturity mismatch, that you can't roll over your credit or get the full value of your asset; the fire sale problem, as it's called; and market risk, that variation of asset prices can lead to great losses for financial institutions. And the manifestations of instability, obviously the one we think of most is bank runs. You get a panic run on a bank, and that happens following the various mechanisms we've discussed, and that leads to their maturity mismatch, the fact that the assets are long term, the liabilities are short term, and boy have we seen a few of those recently. An important point, and this is one of mine as well, I'll have to say, is that we can apply the bank run concept to the securities market. The point that I make here is to say this, that a liquid securities market is like a bank in the sense that it provides a form of liquidity insurance to the holders. It means that you can trade your claim at a shorter maturity than the eventual maturity of your bond or money market instrument. On the other hand, if the market makers decide that it's too dangerous to buy or sell in the securities market, you get a collapse of liquidity in the securities market, and then the thing, they become loans instead of securities. And I argue that that's equivalent to a bank run, and that market liquidity risk is a huge issue that we now have to take into account. Contagion, failure of one market affecting another, via direct links or uncertainty about solvency, asymmetric information. One for you, I guess, again, is that Latvia, I understand, is not in very good shape. You are in good shape. The issue is, do the markets understand the distinction between Latvia and Estonia? If not, then it's an issue of contagion. That's something you would want to avoid. And generalized failure of institutions due to a common shock. I think it's important, again, to distinguish these different aspects here, that you can have a common shock, an oil price collapse, or an oil price rise, that affects countries in a contagious manner, but it's occurring from a central cause. On the other hand, the idea of direct counterparty links is obviously a cross-section thing, and the general uncertainty, because they look similar, that's a third kind. So these are actually three kinds of contagion, right? And that's worth remembering. Contagion isn't homogeneous either. Often when we think about contagion, we just think about interbank links, for example. But this kind of contagion, they look the same. They've both been lending to commercial property. That's important. This one is important as well. Any questions at that point? I hope you'll just, as I say, this is the first lecture I think is particularly useful as background, because through the rest of the course we'll be having these things in mind. Theory hasn't stopped in recent years. There's been some very useful stuff that's been building on these, and you can dig out the references in the, particularly in the paper called Macroprudential Policy, the Missing Policy Pillar, which is background for Lecture 6. So if you want to read some of this stuff, the references are in there. Franklin Allen talks about links between asset bubbles and fragility, the argument being that banks lend, that drives up asset prices. The asset prices may then get into a bubble because it's expected that credit availability is high, and banks in a sense shift risk to the authorities as they take those sorts of risk. Fraxas et al. Talk about contagion, modeling counterparty risks, as well as aggregate shocks. I just talked about these three different kinds of contagion. Work by Phraxis et al. Is useful in that area. I call this ASFACTS, but the person we'll know about in this one is Charles Goodhart, defining fragility. They talk about bank profitability and default probability as key indicators that fragility is there. Hyun Shin is a very important author at the moment. He's done lots of really useful work. Talks about risk and liquidity at a system-wide level. For example, the fact that recently we've seen lots of institutions holding CDOs, all of which have devalued at once. So that's what he called webs of risk. Kocher Lakota et al. Have talked more about the regulators, the incentives. This is a very important word, forbearance. Forbearance means you can see there's a problem, but you hope it'll go away, so you don't do anything about it. We'll talk about that in lecture three, versus doing something about it quickly. Prompt corrective action might be expensive. Do we really want to do that? That's the big tension that the regulators face if there's a bank in difficulty. Kocher Lakota and others argue that they will make a judgment on asset price movements and do their changes on the basis of that. So that's the theories, if you like. Obviously, that's a very quick whistle stop. There's lots of background. You can look at the references, the summaries that I've done in the background papers. I would go on to argue that crises, they seem diverse, but the generic types can be distinguished. So I'm arguing firstly that there's a general generic pattern, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but also that there are three generic types of crisis. And the first one is the most obvious one that we all think about, which is bank failures, the banking crisis after they make loan or trading losses. Okay, so that's not much new. I would argue, though, that as financial systems become more securitized, that we have new kinds of crisis. And the first one is what I would call a liquid market crisis. And the second one, or the number three, is an illiquid market crisis. Okay, let me clarify. Number two is we get asset price volatility, and because there are leveraged institutions holding the asset, e.g. banks, investment banks, hedge funds, we have systemic consequences. So the equity price collapses, as I said earlier. If it's pension funds and households, well, too bad. But if it's banks that were holding it, maybe because there was an IPO going on, then that could wipe out the bank's capital. Okay? So we can have systemic consequences of asset price volatility. And then the third one, and this assumes that the market keeps on operating, but there are side effects. The third one, on the other hand, is that the collapse of market liquidity and issuance, following what I said earlier about a bank run on a securities market, that the market makers don't find it worthwhile trading anymore, so you can't actually sell your asset in volume or at all. And let me just say that asset volatility and liquidity is usually maintained when we get a collapse in FX or equity markets, okay? Usually you get liquidity maintained in those markets. On the other hand, if it's a debt market or a derivatives market, we often get a liquidity collapse. I think you can't always make that distinction, but that's a useful one to think about. Why does it matter if debt market liquidity collapses? There's two reasons. Firstly, it hits those who are holding positions because they're either not able to sell or they're not able to sell at the price they would like. But also, there may be institutions that rely on that debt market for their own liquidity. And here we only have to think about the international or domestic interbank markets as an example there. If the liquidity of the interbank market has collapsed, then banks will go bust unless the central bank steps in. So those are distinctions that are helpful, and what I've got here is a very selective set of episodes. It doesn't include, for example, a lot of the crises that happened in Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Doesn't include Turkey 2001, Argentina 2001, etc. All I'm showing you this for is to say, if you look early on, mainly they were bank failures following loan losses. But if we look more recently, we've seen more of these securities-related collapses. So, for example, the ERM crisis, I see as price volatility, the bond market reversal at 94, and of course Russia LTCM and the subprime crisis were classic cases of number three, collapse of market liquidity and issuance. They weren't the only things, but they're the primary things, if you like. If you like, the reason I've chosen these is that they're A, in advanced countries, and B, they affected the international capital markets. But as I say, there were lots of crises in emerging countries that I haven't included.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
I have one question. Do you have examples for banking sector and security market? But do you have any examples related to the insurance sector?
Apparently there was in Jamaica. In Jamaica, the insurance sector decided to issue deposit-like its instruments in order to finance itself. And because it was doing that, then it was subject to maturity mismatch. And then there was an insurance company crisis. I have written another paper on annuities markets, which talks about insurance. But it is pretty rare, and I think the reason is that insurance companies have a maturity match that banks don't have, if you like. There's a running from insurance companies is much harder than from banks. It can be done with what's called policy loans on life insurance. That's something that the Americans worry about, that you're able to borrow on contractual terms. But generally, I would say insurance companies have been safer than banks, yeah. Okay. Some subcategories of financial turbulence. As you saw, there's a paper called the Typology of Financial Crises, which I'm talking about a bit here. Financial deregulation, that inexperienced institutions and regulators allow a build-up of debt. And I mentioned Sweden there, but lots and lots and lots of countries have financially liberalized, and then they've ended up with a crisis during the first credit cycle. And you can see why if we think back to our theories, because financial fragility says you get a crash after an upturn, but monetarist and uncertainty theory says you only get a crash if it's something that you couldn't have predicted. And financial liberalization generates a situation that the financial sector and the regulators have not seen before, which is an upturn in a financially liberalized system. So all the red warning signals start showing when we get deregulation. Disintermediation and reintermediation, that when we develop securities markets, then the top firms will very often start issuing their debt to bondholders because it's cheaper than borrowing from banks. If banks then lose the top-rated borrowers that they used to have, they'll look somewhere else, and where they look may end up being much riskier. And we'll talk a bit about Japan in a minute. Failure of a single large institution, Continental Illinois, we'll talk about in Lecture 3. If one institution is at the core of the system, then that can be a systemic risk. This is where we start thinking about the concept of too big to fail, that as central bankers we would like to get rid of, but it's in people's heads. The problem of commodities and commercial property, those are again issues that the authorities have to be very aware of. If your economy is commodity based, then the price of that is volatile. If there's a lot of lending on commodities, then that can be a problem of lead to crisis. Commercial property especially, but in this crisis residential property has been a big issue. I just mentioned Finland there. In a later lecture, I shall talk to you about commercial property and the issues it raises. These link as well to heavy demands for external finance as well as volatility. And if you look in last week's Economist, you'll see that at the moment, everyone outside the central banking and financial community are starting to think, well, it's all over, but there's a big elephant in the room, which is commercial property. Yeah? If you look at the first page of the UK, it says commercial property is only just starting to emerge as a big cause of debt, and commercial property is a late cycle phenomenon. So we're not necessarily out of the woods, and commercial property may be a big problem right now in a lot of countries. International debt problems. We talked about international aspects, Latin America, Mexico, issue in Eastern Europe as well, foreign currency liabilities, and also what we call the twin crisis problem. You get currency and banking crises together and contagion. Equity market linkages, that you get the leveraged institutions. I've talked about that already, the 87 crash. So what I'll do now is talk about archetypal examples, just to give you a feel for what happens in the three main types that I've outlined. And the first one is indeed the Japanese banking crisis. And some features of the Japanese banking crisis. And let me just say that I think that we're not going to learn about financial instability by just looking at theory. I really think it's important, even though it seems, you know, why is he talking about this particular case? My country's not like this. I think it's really important to know historic examples of crises, because they all have things to teach us, and theory alone is not sufficient for us to do analysis of financial crises. There are always things to learn. Japan used to be a miracle economy. Everyone was scared of the Japanese. Right through the 1980s, we thought they were going to take over the world, they were going to run the banking system as well as selling us all the electronic goods, and all we would end up with is unemployment. When I say we, I think about Europe and America. The Japanese economy indeed did very, very well up to 1990. Now, you remember what I said about disintermediation and re-intermediation? Basically, that was the pattern that the Japanese had in the 80s. They had strong credit expansion in the 80s, first of all, because households were saving a lot. And that, incidentally, is linked to something that people often forget about, which I'm going to come back to on Friday. This is something, again, lurking in the background. Demographics. Never forget about demographics. They have an effect on financial behavior. The Japanese were getting old at a very rapid rate, on average, and they wanted to save a lot for pensions, right? So that helps expand the credit. Where did the credit go? This is the disintermediation problem. The large firms were borrowing from banks or taking their own profits. They were so profitable because there had been financial liberalization in 1980, allowing securities markets to operate. And the Japanese kept saying how brilliant they were because they were only liberating very gradually, and so they were going to avoid everyone else's problems. That's what they kept saying throughout the 80s. And, you know, I feel sorry for them. I don't sort of laugh at them. It's a huge problem they have now. So who were the banks going to lend to? The banks lent to real estate. Not only that, not only directly, but also via what they called non-bank banks, a beautiful Japanese invention, but before we laugh, we can talk about conduits, we can talk about SIVs. There have always been new kinds of institutions invented in order to increase aggregate credit risk exposure. In Japanese case, it was what we call non-bank banks. The macroeconomy also, and monetary policy also involved. The Americans pushed the Japanese to cut interest rates in the mid-80s, what they call the Louvre Accord, and that just made the policy, the situation even more frenetic in terms of a credit boom and an asset price boom as well. And in the background, this is the sort of industrial point. The banks had found it very hard to adjust to low growth since the early 70s. They'd been lending at a very rapid rate till 73. The safety net, it was said the authorities would always rescue banks. Herding, that you tried not to, you tried to do the same as everyone else. This is Keynes who said this. He said a sound banker, more or less, a sound banker is not someone who is prudent, but the one who makes the same mistakes as everyone else, so that no one can blame him, okay? So the Japanese were following Keynes, they were all doing the same thing, and they hoped that would be safe for them. Not really much of a credit culture. And the famous story is that in 1988-89, the price of real estate in Japan was so high that the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo, this may only be a story, but it's a nice story, the Emperor's Palace in Tokyo was worth more than the state of California. I'm not sure that's quite right, but it gives you an idea of what madness was going on. And, yeah?
What did you mean under this lack of credit culture?
A lack of credit culture, that they weren't making a calculation of, PDs and likely LDs and PDs and all that stuff. They were just lending on a volume basis and not in a sense making a forward calculation of the likelihood of default, that sort of thing, yeah. Which is, I'm afraid, typical of all financial systems when they first get liberalized. It takes time to build that up, because when you're not liberalized, you're in a super position as a bank, because you lend to people who are very high credit quality, and you ration credit to everyone else, so they're not going to default either. So suddenly you have to build up this credit analysis. It takes time, yeah? Then in 1989, the asset price inflation started affecting the real economy, and that led the central bank to put restrictions on real estate, tighten monetary policy, and that was when everything started to collapse. Equity prices, real estate, non-performing loans, capital ratios as well started to fall. And the authorities took a very long time to react. Basically, although the crisis started in 1990, the major crisis was in 1997. That was when banks really started to collapse. And what the authorities did first was that they put blanket deposit insurance guarantees on. That was right from the early days, 91. And they also provided a certain amount of liquidity. But as I said, the crisis really intensified in 97, and it was only in 98 that the authorities started injecting capital into banks. And this is often called the Japanese lesson, as opposed to the Swedish lesson. The Swedes would inject capital very early on. The Japanese took years to start putting in capital, partly because the public hated the banks for making all these losses. The public were very against banking support in Japan. So it was only when in 97-98 the whole thing started to look like it would collapse that they were able to put in capital. And at the same time, the central bank put in zero interest rates and very, very large liquidity. So from 99 onwards, the thing has gradually sorted itself out. But that was what there we did have insurance company collapses, following the point earlier, as well as investment banks. And we've had what they call the lost decade, whereas it's more like the lost decade and a half now. Credit constraints, fiscal crisis, high saving, and the bankrupt firms carrying on operating. And if we think back to the theories, we can see that many of them are validated by what we saw in Japan. We can see that there's the financial fragility theory of the credit cycle. We can see that the uncertainty theory to do with financial liberalization, this is the first time it happened. The industrial theory with the non-bank banks, new entry, more credit. agency and regulation, the expectation of being bailed out by the safety net. So the Japanese crisis is really a very important one and very well worth further study. Any question? Okay, let me talk about, I'll be a bit more brief, talk about the stock market crash of 87. Remember, we've got three kinds of crisis we're looking at. Firstly, the banking crisis, that's Japan. Secondly, the asset price volatility affecting the systemic institutions, and that's this one. So in 87, we had very buoyant expectations, very high stock market prices, suspicion of a bubble, and I'm very, how should we say, I'm pleased that Joe Bisignano and I in April of that year wrote a very warning piece in the BIS annual report saying that this might happen, and actually someone did notice that, which was very pleasing. On the other hand, I didn't predict the subprime crisis, let me say. So I don't claim omniscience. Anyway, herding by institutional investors, we're talking mainly about institutions here, pension funds, life insurance. Why were they willing to hold assets, hold equities, when they knew there was a bubble? And the point here is to do with the illusion of liquidity linked to an innovation, which is portfolio insurance. Those of you in financial market areas will know that sort of thing. It's dynamic hedging, basically, means of seeking to protect your position by holding offsetting futures or options against the own position that you've got. This portfolio insurance was sold by investment banks as something very powerful that would protect the holder against price falls. So people were willing to hold these assets at very high prices because they expected to be protected or to be able to exit. We had some news. The Americans and the Germans were arguing about exchange rates in early October, and we also had a hurricane in England, which closed the city for a day. I don't know if any of you remember this. But yes, I couldn't get to work. There were so many trees on the line. That was on the Friday before the crash, which happened on the Monday, October the 19th. But, you know, this is not sufficient if we think of the efficient markets hypothesis, right? The efficient markets hypothesis says price changes have got to be related to something that is commensurate with them. Somewhat disproven in this case, as in many other cases. No news that was sufficient to generate a 30% fall in equity prices that we got in one day. Okay. What was actually happening on the Monday when we got this 30% fall was an interaction in the futures markets between the portfolio insurance and index arbitrage. Index arbitrage are just people who buy and sell futures to try and make a profit from discrepancies with the true price. And there's lots of reports on this, I won't go in detail, but basically some were trying to buy, some were trying to sell at the same time. The insurers drove down the market, the futures got to a discount, the arbitrageurs again sold futures, so you got what we call a cascade. According to the Brady report at the time. And so that was going on in the background in the futures market. The front-end equity market, of course, was collapsing as well. Institutional investors heavily involved. We got a lot of cross-border effects. One thing you find with international institutional investors is when there's a crisis, they sell the foreign assets, even if the fundamentals are more at home. They repatriate, they get home bias when there's a crisis like that. And that leads to a spreading of the crisis everywhere else, even if they're not affected. And this is the systemic bit, that the brokers and dealers suddenly found that no one wanted to lend to them. Their inventories of securities were devaluing. We're talking here about the US investment banks. At the same time, there was a big IPO. BP in the UK, the petrol company, was being part sold. And it was just the day when the investment banks had got all the inventory and guaranteed the price. Suddenly those holdings of BP were collapsing in price as well. So the Fed, the Bank of England, were getting really worried that they would get a systemic crisis from the collapse of investment banks and commercial banks. So this is when Greenspan, who was new at the Fed, stepped in and said, we'll provide as much liquidity as possible, go and lend. That did happen. The emergency liquidity worked. On the other hand, they also cut interest rates at a time when actually the cycle was not cooling really. But that was a time when they said, well, this is a knife edge. We get a Great Depression or we get inflation, we'll take the risk. And so they got inflation, which had to be sorted out in the years afterwards. So, yeah, that's the stock market crisis. You can see uncertainty related to innovation. You can see herding. Again, the theories come through. Securities liquidity, I think the number three crisis, the Russia LTCM is worth looking at here. And you'll be more familiar with this probably. It's fairly recent. I guess it may have affected Estonia. 1998, of course. So again, we saw the equity market rising as well as bond spreads contracting over that period. We had the Asian crisis in 97, but somehow it didn't much affect the US securities markets or the global capital markets. July 1999, we saw a sort of plateauing, and you remember we said that it's an adverse shock that has to happen to a vulnerable market to get a problem. And in 1998, we had two adverse shocks. And the first one was the Russian moratorium on its debt, which you'll remember, no doubt. So that shocked the market that had got very complacent about emerging market risk. And secondly, we had the hedge fund LTCM that had taken a lot of bets on credit risk spreads. They thought that credit risk spreads were too wide and they would renormalize to some lower level. They'd made enormous bets on those spreads. The interesting thing was that the bets that LTCM were making were not on risky emerging market debt at all. They were actually mainly on US treasuries. And they were betting that the liquidity spread between on-the-run and off-the-run treasuries would renormalize. On-the-run are the new ones that are quite liquid. Off-the-run are the previous ones issued years before that are not liquid, and there's a spread because of liquidity. No credit risk at all. But LTCM was caught in a generalized flight to quality caused by the Russian default. After the Russian default, everyone rethought their risk appetite. They rethought what they'd previously been thinking about risk. And this is very familiar from what we've just seen, right? It's a rethinking about risk that happened. And people got out of emerging markets, they got out of corporate, they got out of anything except advanced OECD governments. And LTCM got caught in that. Flight to quality is what I'm just telling you about, basically. And then we saw the debt market liquidity collapse. You couldn't issue and the markets got illiquid, even when the markets were very deep in normal times. And what we saw, there was a really good IMF capital markets report that talked about this, was that investors were herding. Not in the familiar way of everyone buying the same asset, singular, but what they were doing was that they were all diversifying in the same way, okay? They thought they were diversified, but everyone else was doing the same thing. That's what we call a lack of macro portfolio diversification. We saw price and liquidity shifts in markets that were previously uncorrelated. That's typical, again, of a big crisis. We saw it in spades in October 2008. And value at risk models had become very important. They'd been accepted in Basel in 1996 that you could run a value at risk model, which, bear in mind, is to do with calculating the normal loss that you could make on your portfolio. given historic volatility. The value at risk models were basically telling the institutions, sell these assets because the volatility has gone outside normal bounds, which actually generated endogenous risk. This is another big issue that's worth bearing in mind. A naive view of risk is that it's something exogenous, that it's something that comes from outer space, and therefore you just have to protect yourself with capital and that's fine, okay? And in a sense, the Russian default was an exogenous risk. No one could have predicted that the Kremlin would suddenly say, we're not going to pay interest, at least for a while. On the other hand, the ongoing Russia LTCM crisis was hugely to do with endogenous risk, because it was the interaction of the different markets. It was the market makers deciding not to hold out positions anymore, not answer the telephone anymore, that led, and then the selling due to the risk models. It's all endogenous, it's within the market, it makes the thing worse and worse. And that's a very important distinction to bear in mind. Basically, what did the authorities do? They didn't want to lend to a hedge fund. They locked the banks in a room with some coffee and biscuits at the New York Fed, and they said, you sort this out. And the banks decided it was in their interest to rescue LTCM. The authorities helped with some interest rate cuts, which, again, in retrospect, probably made the peak of the bubble in 2000 even worse, but it was maybe worth it given the dangers at that time. So those are your three archetypal crises, and as I say, it's worth it looking at those in detail. In particular, I think the lessons of Russia LTCM could have been better learned in time for this crisis. We might have had a better response to it or a quicker understanding of it. What I think the combination of theory and experience do is to help us to move towards this generic patterns that I was aiming for. What are the generic features that tend to precede crises? And these are some aspects, you know, they're just my list, you may have a different one, but they help to summarize the sorts of things we can look for. There's the regime shift to laxity or other favorable shock, financial fragility theory, something nice happens, the Japanese economy is doing well, etc., etc. The new entry, hedge funds suddenly start getting involved in debt markets, for example. We get lots of debt accumulation, borrowing in Japan, for example. Lots of borrowing before Russia LTCM as well. Asset price booms in Japan, in all three cases I've just told you about. Financial innovation, the portfolio insurance before the stock market crash, the non-bank banks in Japan, etc. Remember, innovation, a key generator of uncertainty, okay? Underpricing of risk, risk concentration, lower capital adequacy. The banks generally get to be risk-loving. They don't protect themselves as well as they should have done. We might add a higher maturity mismatch. So they get vulnerable to credit risk, they get vulnerable to liquidity risk, they might get vulnerable to market risk as well. Something nasty happens, a regime shift to rigor or other adverse shock. Then we get credit rationing, we may need the safety net, we may get a severe crisis. And this table is something that I think is helpful. It's something that I thought of as well, and I'll return to it at various times. This tries to summarize these points, and it talks about phases, right, of the site of the crisis. So, as I say, we've got our primary shock, we've got then what I call, and this is the really important one, propagation, the build-up of vulnerability. Then we have the adverse shock, we have the crisis, we have policy action, we have economic consequences. And if you like, the shocks are the exogenous bits and the propagation are the endogenous bits, okay? And I really emphasize this is the important one. if we spot this, then we may be able to either head off the crisis or at least make it not as bad as it would otherwise be. So the nature of the primary shock is diverse. You can't really predict them. You just have to see they happen when they did happen. Deregulation is typical, but also policy easing, invention, market sentiment, etc. The 1990s equity boom, for example, was due to the invention of the internet. Everyone thought this was the answer to everything, and therefore stock prices hit the roof in 2000. Then we had the dot-com collapse from 2000 to 2002, massive collapse of equity markets. But those are just shocks. Shocks are always happening. Propagation, as I say, this is the issue. Is the financial system going to react to that shock in a way that makes it less robust and more vulnerable? Is it going to act? And this is where macroprudential surveillance comes in. This is where we need to spot what's happening. And our indicators are the ones pretty much that I mentioned: new entry, debt accumulation, asset price, innovation, underpricing of risk, etc. So it's that period when we can see something bothering, something concerning. We can advise the regulators or the monetary policy authorities or indeed the fiscal authorities to do something about it. If we allow vulnerability to generate, then we get an adverse shock, again diverse, of those sorts of kinds. And I include their asymmetric trade shock. The classic example there is Finland in 1991. The Russia Soviet Union collapsed, which is very nice for Estonia, but the collapse of the Soviet Union at the time was very bad for Finland because they'd been trading a lot with Russia and the Soviet Union, and that helped generate the Finnish banking crisis. Propagation, the crisis, that's common. We get the failures, we get the runs, due to the various forms of contagion. Policy action that we'll talk about, including not just the safety net, but monetary easing. And then the economic consequences, credit rationing, uncertainty, particular collapse in investment. And how bad those are depend on how bad the crisis is, but also how much the authorities react, whether they can affect sentiment in particular. So that's a table that I hope is helpful, and I'll return to it. Here's Japan. So in Japan, deregulation of securities markets, monetary easing, I think the general good performance of the economy. Propagation, again, new entry, non-banks, debt accumulation by property companies, commercial property boom, underpricing of risk, etc. Secondary shock, monetary and regulatory tightening. The crisis itself, the asset price collapse, insolvency of institutions. Incidentally, what happened in Japan was that the accounting was a bad thing as well. It said as long as the borrower is still paying the debts, then you don't have to record it as a bad debt. So what the banks did was what was called evergreening. They lent money to the firms that they knew were bankrupt, so that the firms could then repay them and they wouldn't have to record the loss on the balance sheet. Accounting can be another issue. Policy action, deposit insurance, lender of last resort, recapitalization, etc. So,
can I ask one question about the last slide, that this second propagation of industrial vulnerability and then the examples of features, that how often or strong is the feature that the capital adequacy will be lower during this phase?
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? On the face of it, we should be enforcing our Basel capital adequacy regulation, and therefore that shouldn't happen. But I can think of certain ways in which it could nonetheless. One is that the regulators sometimes have targets in excess of Basel, and they may be tempted to shave those and leave it above Basel. Indeed, you'll remember that the advanced IRB approach to Basel was going to allow the banks to hold less capital because the authorities would say they're so good at risk management that we're going to allow them to have lower capital. So that's another way. Another way is that you may get capital arbitrage. For example, the invention of new kinds of ways for banks to get exposure, like SIVs and conduits, which effectively reduced capital adequacy because the banks were in the end exposed to those SIVs and conduits. And another way is that risk may not be correctly measured within the risk buckets. And again, we've seen that because they thought that the CDO tranches were AAA. In retrospect, they should have been BAA or something. So, you know, on the face of it, that shouldn't happen, but you can still see it might. And that's why we need a leverage ratio as well as a risk asset ratio, which we'll talk about later for banks, I think. Here's a few crises in recent years. You can see how the different features came in. Some did, some didn't. The Russia LTCM, as well as the subprime, had very, very most of them during that period. Points to note, I'll start to wind up this one. The causes aren't confined to the crisis itself, but the earlier boom period, and the vulnerability and endogenous risk I've just talked about. Asymmetric information and incentives are very important. We'll talk about that in the second lecture. And the common shocks, as well as contagion, are important as well, and I'll keep on insisting on that. There are three kinds of contagion. The direct asset price or counterparty relationships, which are the thing we most think about, mainly the borrowing relationships in the interbank market, say. But we can also have contagion due to asset price collapse in one country leading to collapse elsewhere, or the common shock that is neither related to either of them but affects them both. So the conclusion of this one is that I'm talking about financial instability as a process, not just the crisis itself, but the build-up of vulnerability. We've talked about sources of crises as well as theories that hopefully are helpful in thinking about these things. And I'm arguing that the experience suggests three archetypes, but a number of subcategories. Banking crises are still important, but also we need to think about securities markets. And when you join the Eurozone, which hopefully will be soon, then that will be something to look at across the Eurozone, not just in the domestic economy. The assessment of crises underlies the importance of theory. I've talked about the generic features of crisis that I think are important. We'll talk later about macroprudential surveillance and also incentives, but that's probably enough for now. Any questions before we have a coffee break? I think what we could do maybe is have why don't we have a half an hour coffee break rather than a quarter, or is that? Yeah, then everyone can unwind a bit. Or do you think it's too long? You think it's okay? Okay, good. And you're free to talk to me, of course, in the break. So we start again at 1:45.
Yes.
You can feel that's all right. You might wander off. I think that's probably the best way to do the program as well. If I make it a little bit shorter, then yeah. Sorry? Yeah, I'll have to see. Maybe I'll then. I've never liked so much in a day.
But you have some experience in the church.
In the Brunel as well. My normal lectures are 2 hours, so.
Now you have 8 hours.
Yes.
Come on, the
bond, the bond, the bond.